Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well. How are you?
I'm well. I understand that we should share with our listeners today that unfortunately, had to spend a little time in the hospital. One of your kids was a little under the weather.
Yeah, and, she's doing pretty well now. So none of our listeners should be worried.
Yeah, but I do want the world to know that New Brunswick, New Jersey hospitals are a large part of our economy mm-hmm. here. It's a robust city and it's a wonderful place to do business. We have St. Peter's and Robert Wood Johnson Hospital are the main hospitals here, and the Children's Hospital of New Jersey and the Cancer Institute of New Jersey. If I broke my leg anywhere in the state of New Jersey, mm-hmm. in the parking lot of another hospital in South Jersey or North Jersey, I would have the ambulance drive me to Robert Wood Johnson.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't live in New Brunswick. And so a lot of our doctors are up farther north of here. And so our doctors were sending us various places for tests here or there, other hospitals, and I'm not going to say the other hospitals, but other places where everything was just fine. And finally, my daughter was sick for about 8 weeks, and I said,
That's a long time.
We need to find out what's going on here. And so we took her to Robert Wood. And 3 days later, we had an answer as to what the problem was.
And I'm sorry.
It was great.
I just want to fill in one thing. And the difficult diagnosis doctor called you with it. The other hospitals didn't even have a difficult diagnosis center. And it was amazing. Totally amazing.
It was great. But the reason I talk about this particular hospital visit is because – any place I'm going, anywhere I'm doing, I'm at. I'm looking at, the hospitality, the service. How does it all work? How does it interplay? Because that's an important part of what I do. And I was at the hospital, and I'll tell you, we're raising the bar, okay. And Robert Wood obviously is an exceptional hospital, and they do exceptional things.
Raising the bar in regard to?
To service. We all remember going to the hospital. I'm sure that most of us have done it at some point in our life, had a hospital stay.
And the Jell-O and the beige chicken.
Beige chicken comes whenever it comes, and you're asleep, and you don't want to eat it, and it gets cold, and whatever. Okay? Basically, what the Robert Wood Children's Hospital, I haven't been to regular Robert Wood in quite some time, so I can't speak for that. But basically, what they've set up is a 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. room service. Like a hotel. And the idea, from what I gather, is that it is to make you feel more like you're in a hotel than you're in a hospital. And the rooms are nice, and they have much more of a hotel feel to them. And I noticed this when Jennifer's given birth at Robert Wood all four times. And I noticed this when we went there, but I thought, that's just a special thing for maternity wards. But it seems to be moving its way all the way through the hospital to make you feel like you're in a hotel more than you're in a hospital. And I think it just tells something about service, and it tells us something about expectations and what we've come to expect from our service industry.
There's another side to that. I actually, my mom was ill for a while, and she's fine now, and my dad was ill for a while, and sadly he passed away. So up until last year, there was a period of about 4 years where I was dealing with my parents mm-hmm. in and out of doctors and hospitals. And, I do think that Robert Wood Johnson and all those hospitals that I mentioned, the Children's Hospital and the Cancer Institute, are the best in New Jersey. When you go into a major city, you can find hospitals of that character. And my mom was in the hospital for special surgery in New York. And they had a similar kind of thing set up. And I was talking with her nurse practitioner. She was asleep, and I was hanging out. And they said that one of the reasons they do that is because they need you to eat to get better. Mm-hmm. And in some of the hospitals my father was in, where they didn't have that level of service that made it easy for you to eat and made it tasty for you to eat, the doctor kept saying, Frank, you got to eat. Well, and then they, you know, a beige piece of chicken that I would have to choke down as a perfectly healthy person.
And you, and maybe you didn't even have a choice. I mean, I remember as a kid, I didn't have a choice.
So what I, of course, did was I went to great restaurants in Manhattan and I brought my dad dinner. And lo and behold, he ate more when I brought him fresh mozzarella and prosciutto from Fiori's in Hoboken
than he did
Of the beige steamed, lukewarm, microwaved vegetables. But, you know, that speaks to a lot of what we talk about when we talk about eating healthy and eating better. I think it's not – I mean, the hospitals, it makes sense, right, in a hospital. But when we talk about getting our kids to eat good food and getting our kids off processed food and getting ourselves to eat good food, eating whole foods, eating healthy foods is synonymous or should be synonymous with eating tasty foods. It's not about choking down your vegetables that you don't like. It's about getting fresh, tasty, delicious vegetables, which is – I remember – in the 80s, when we had the first great wave of restaurant craze in the United States, people would say, well, you know, this restaurant craze, do you think – because it was in the 80s that Americans eating out or eating takeaway or eating home meal replacement became a larger part of our diet than eating at home. And I remember someone saying, you know, well, this restaurant craze is never going to hold. You'll know when restaurants have really become a part of our culture when you get vegetables in restaurants. And in good restaurants now – you get vegetables, and they're not just a side. It's about eating well. People want to eat well and good.
But even more than the food, this what struck me more than the food, because the food was fine. Okay, the food was it was fine. You know, it came from, you know, a commissary, and it was fine. I no complaints at all about the food. But what really struck me was the service. What really struck me was the desire to make you comfortable, and that doctoring and hospitalization could be a service industry, because I don't think that our generation thinks of it that way.
No, it was, you had to take your medicine.
You had to take your medicine, and with your medicine sometimes came, you know, a two-hour wait in a doctor's office or a six-hour wait in an emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the service industry extending to places like hospitals and doctors is really an interesting phenomenon.
Well, I think even if you look at, you can say bad things about the McGreevy. Certainly, a lot of people have, but it was Jim and Dina McGreevy who fixed. If you're listening from outside New Jersey, as so many of our listeners on the computer are, New Jersey had a division of motor vehicles that is much like the motor vehicle agency in many states. You would, if you wanted to change your registration, take a half a day off from work and hope that if you got there early enough, you could get back to the second half of the day. But you literally, if you had a complex business at the division of motor vehicles,
I remember spending 6-7 hours in Trenton to get a new license.
And they're only open business hours, so you take a day off. Well, the one thing that McGreevy's did is they fixed DMV.
Mm-hmm.
You walk in there, and in 10 minutes, you've got what you need. But it's customer service. And the ideas of service, like in Danny Meyer's book.
Setting the table.
We had Danny Meyer on the show to talk about that. Charlie Trotter lectures on service, not just to the restaurant industry, but the restaurant hotel industry is the beginning of service. This is where our culture of service began, and now it's spreading to other industries, and it should.
I remember watching the show The Restaurant, Rocco DiSpiritu's defunct restaurant, Rocco's, was featured there. And what I remember about one of the things that really rang true to me is a customer asked for something the restaurant didn't have, and one of the waiters went out into New York City to search for it. Now, he failed the restaurant because he didn't tell anybody he was leaving. He didn't cover his station. He made some big mistakes there. But the instinct was, my customer wants this. I'm going to travel into the city and find out what it is.
Yeah, well, when we come back, we're going to talk about a pretty serious topic. We're going to talk about a global seed bank that may prove to be the repository of a lot of the genetic material that we're losing around the world. It's pretty interesting stuff buried in a mountain in Norway. Stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And we're talking today with Carrie Fowler. He is with the Global Crop Diversity Fund, of which he's the executive director. And they have opened the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway.
Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
It's wonderful to talk to you. I've been reading about this seed vault, and it's now open. And we saw you on 60 Minutes recently.
Mm-hmm. Just this Sunday.
They scooped us, damn it.
They do that sometimes.
Oh, man. Anyway, well, we'll take the seconds here.
Look at it this way. You're only 20 minutes on 60 Minutes. You'll be 60 minutes here.
Okay.
Now, tell us about the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Our listeners don't know much about it, and it's a fascinating project.
Okay. Well, let's start off by saying that there are a number of seed banks around the world, and these are facilities that conserve seeds of different varieties of agricultural crops. They conserve them by freezing them, usually. And the purpose is to keep all of this diversity in place and in existence so that plant breeders and farmers will have access to the different traits and characteristics in the future so that we can have an agricultural system that meets changing needs, changing climates, new pests and diseases, different nutritional needs, and things like this. So we want to conserve the diversity of all of our agricultural crops, and there is a tremendous amount of diversity out there to conserve. We have perhaps 200,000 different kinds of rice, as different from one another as maybe a beagle from a Great Dane in the dog world. This is the raw material, the biological foundation of agriculture, and contains all the options that agriculture will have in the future. So the idea behind the seed vault in Norway is simply to provide a safety backup, an insurance policy, if you will, for the different seed banks that are located in much more vulnerable and precarious locations.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. If all these seed vaults are located around the world, why do we need a centralized seed vault in Norway of all places?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have very important collections of crop diversity around the world that are located in some reasonably unsafe locations. And also,
what would make a seed bank unsafe?
Well, a war, civil strife, a typhoon almost destroyed the national seed bank in the Philippines about a year and a half ago. But there are also a lot of mundane reasons where we can lose crop diversity. Just mismanagement and equipment failures and things like that will often cause a seed bank to lose some of its collections. And this happens routinely, I would say, almost on a daily basis. So what we're trying to do with the seed vault is to have a physical location that's very safe, conditions that are excellent, and conditions that don't really, where we don't really depend too much, frankly, on human beings to run it.
So talk to us about the conditions of this seed vault. This is basically better than Fort Knox in a lot of ways.
In many ways, yes. Well, as I mentioned earlier, if you want to conserve seeds for the long term, basically you freeze them. So we've gone fairly close to the North Pole. It's the farthest north you can fly on a regularly scheduled airplane once a day. An island called Spitsbergen, or a group of islands called Svalbard. It's north of mainland Norway, 78 degrees. And we've made a tunnel into the mountain about 125 yards long, into the mountain, into the coldest part of the mountain, where it's naturally below freezing all the time. So we don't literally have to depend on mechanical refrigeration, though, frankly, even though we're that close to the North Pole, we will be freezing it down to an even lower temperature, about -3 or -4 Fahrenheit. And at the end of this long tunnel in this solid stone mountain, and you can imagine the insulation properties are rather extreme and very good.
Yeah, I understand that while a coat is very good, a mountain is much better.
Right, that's true. We're going to have 3 rooms, and each of these rooms is capable of storing about 1.5 million samples of different agricultural crops. Now, to put that in perspective, we think that probably only about 1.5 million exist. So our idea is to assemble a sample, meaning about 400 or 500 seeds, of each of the agricultural varieties that exist at the moment, and to provide these as an insurance policy for seed banks. So if they lose all or part of their collection through an accident or through a war or a fire at their facility or whatever, that we will have a backup copy of what they had in the past, a problem like that occurring in a seed bank has literally meant extinction. It's meant that a particular variety, potentially a variety that was going to be very useful to help wheat combat the next disease or help rice deal with climate change, would have been lost forever.
When we come back, I want to talk more about this high-tech facility. There's a certain James Bond aspect to the security features of it, which are pretty exciting and thrilling. And after the news, we're going to go on and talk about why exactly a seed bank like this is more necessary than ever and could prove to be very important for the whole world. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Carrie Fowler of the Global Crop Diversity Fund. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Carrie Fowler of the Global Crop Diversity Fund and the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway. Carrie, this is basically the world's backup system for a lot of its genetic diversity in crops and food crops especially. You have some pretty cool security there. Like I've read that no one person has the security code.
Well,
is that true?
There are several security systems and quite a few doors that you would need to go through to get to the seeds themselves. And the keys are coded, so we will know in the instantly who has gone through door 1, 3, 2, 3, 4.
See, Francis thinks James Bond. I think Maxwell Smart.
Yeah,
but, that's
right.
It's just
so, but you know, frankly, I mean, we've tried to develop a facility here that's really meant to last for centuries or even thousands of years. So, in thinking about building such a facility, we really tried to make it more robust, stronger, more secure than we even thought would be needed. I mean, seed banks are really never the targets of terrorism. There's no political or religious group that's against
seeds.
Having seeds.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you never know what's going to happen in the future. So we have the world's most secure facility by, you know, order of magnitude of 100 or more, I'm sure.
So you're impenetrable from nuclear attack, from earthquake. You're pretty much okay.
Well, we had the strongest earthquake in Norwegian history the week before the opening. I like to say it was just a trial run. But, it didn't do a thing to the seed vault.
Well, and the thing, if you lose power, the seed vault should be able to keep those seeds alive for how long?
Decades. It'll be below freezing, and that's even the worst-case climate change scenario for 200 years out. But even if climate change comes in a dramatic fashion to the Arctic, which, of course, it seems to be doing, will still be really insulated. And
Carrie, we're going to leave you there. We're going to come back after the news and talk about why this has been called the Doomsday Vault and what role it has to play and why it's so important. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Carrie Fowler of the Global Crop Diversity Fund. They've built in Svalbard, Norway, tunneled 150 yards into a mountain, one of the world's most secure facilities to protect the global diversity of crops and seeds. Carrie, they're calling this the Doomsday Vault. Why did it get that moniker?
Well, that's a bit of a media creation, I have to admit. I try to stress that doomsday actually comes just about every day for one or more crop varieties. We're losing a lot of crop diversity every day around the world in very silent ways. This is stuff that doesn't hit the newspapers. And so the seed vault is really meant to protect the diversity that we have in our agricultural crops from these kinds of situations, kind of the drip, drip, drip of extinction, frankly. But it's true that I think if there were larger catastrophes, regional, national, regional, or perhaps even global, that if there is any kind of hope that we might conserve crop diversity in such a catastrophic situation, then probably that hope rests with what we have inside the seed vault.
Now, let's talk about global diversity. I have some statistics in front of me, and you can attest to the veracity of them or not. I've read that historically humans cultivated about 7,000 species for food crops, and that currently we get about 90% of our diet from 20 species. So, first of all, do you know if that is true? If not the specific numbers, if it's true in general, and why? What's going on that's so different in the way we farm now?
Well, historically, human beings have used a lot of different kinds of foods, principally from our hunting and gathering days, but a rather limited number of those were domesticated, and of those, but in those domesticated crops, we have a huge amount of diversity. I mean, we have rice that can grow under 6-7 meters of water, and rice that can grow in semi-arid conditions. We have maize that can grow in almost every country of the world. So there's a tremendous amount of diversity visually in terms of environmental adaptability. And the real task, and I think people don't ordinarily appreciate this, is making sure that that kind of development or evolution in our agricultural crops can continue. A lot of people think that the bread that they eat today tastes pretty much the way it did 10 or 15 years ago, but I can almost promise you that it's made with a different variety of wheat because pests and diseases in the environment are always changing, and the crops have to keep up with that. And so you ask yourself, well, how do they keep up with that? And they keep up with changes in the environment with our help. They're domesticated crops, and plant breeders and farmers are always selecting for and developing new varieties. If they don't do that, then we have a food system which is really untenable and will eventually collapse. So,
and the faster the world changes, the more diversity we need.
In a sense, and the interesting thing about the current discussions about climate change is that everyone sort of is willing to acknowledge that we have to adapt to climate change somehow. Well, how is it that we're going to adapt? And we obviously agriculture is going to have to adapt, but agriculture cannot adapt to climate change if crops do not adapt to climate change. And the way crops will adapt is by finding the diversity in the existing gene pools of our different crops that will give us the heat tolerance or the drought tolerance or whatever we need for the new environments, and making sure that those qualities are in the new crop varieties of the future. And so we have to save the old crop varieties in order to produce new varieties.
One of the things that we talk about very often on this show, we talk about restaurants a lot, we also talk a lot with farmers and people who write books on farming, as well as people who actually do it and people who grow animals, mostly for related to food, crops for food. One of the things that we find very disturbing is the amount of monocultures, so the number of monocultures, the lack of diversity among types of crops. So As we, what happens is corporate agribusiness, which farms, say, corn, say, millions and millions of acres of corn, miles of corn sometimes in a farm, they'll find the particular type of corn, clone of corn, and species of corn that does the best and gives them the highest profit. And they'll plant miles of this corn, which is different from what used to be, where there were many different farmers who planted slightly different, genetically different crops over a period of time. So we have greater risks with monocultures like that. One pest, which might have been in a different time when we had more diversity of even among that one crop corn, might have hit four or five farmers, can now destroy miles and miles or a whole country or a whole world's worth of corn, can it?
Well, that's true. I mean, genetic uniformity in the field can make acre after acre genetically vulnerable to a new pest or disease. And I'm like you. I love diversity in the foods that I eat and value tomatoes that are good for eating fresh and some that are good for making this kind of pasta sauce or another. I live in Rome right now. And I think what we're trying to do at the Global Crop Diversity Trust is to preserve all of those options for the future. We can't determine how agriculture is going to go in the future, but we can certainly save all the pieces. So hopefully someday we'll have flourishing diversity in the farmers' fields and in the marketplace, and we'll have great-tasting tomatoes and good-tasting corn. We can do our part by saving all that diversity now. But, of course, that's not enough to have a successful agricultural system, as you well know.
I loved an expression you used that I heard you say. When a plant goes extinct, it's like a color that we can't use anymore. It's like a color that's no longer on our palate.
Well, I do think of this in sort of artistic terms. We can have an impoverished agricultural system that, to some extent, could continue to function. But every time one of our old crop varieties becomes extinct, we lose the taste, the qualities, the nutritional qualities, the disease and pest resistance, and a little bit of our culture as well, frankly. And that's something we don't get back. So every time we lose it, we lose a color. And you can take colors off of the artist's palette, and the artist can continue to paint pictures. But they're impoverished pictures at a certain point. And we don't need to do that, particularly when agriculture is facing so many crises, and we need to preserve our options in order to deal with them.
And if you're not really moved by the artistic argument, let's talk about a mechanical argument. When we have these species, as new things constantly arise, it is the reblending, not through genetic modification, but through breeding or through genetic modification, but it's using the existing genetic material of crops, and sometimes they're wild relatives, which may not even be domesticated crops, to meet new challenges and meet new changes along the way. If we lose that genetic material, we lose the ability to fight future problems. Did I get that about right?
Well, that's right. I'll give you an example. Years ago, a friend of mine named Jack Harlan collected a wheat variety in Turkey. He described it as a hopelessly useless variety of wheat. It was miserable looking. Had all kinds of problems. It was low yielding, and the pests and diseases liked it. But some 10 or 12 years after that, they found out that, lo and behold, this variety did in fact have resistance to a number of different diseases. They used it in breeding programs, and today it's in the pedigree of virtually all the wheat varieties grown in the northwestern part of the United States, giving farmers a yield increase worth a couple hundred million dollars every year. And if we could somehow capture the economic benefit of just that one miserable-looking variety of wheat from Turkey, the economic benefit from one crop to one section of the United States, we could quite literally have an endowment fund that would be capable of conserving all crop diversity of all different crops
and
forever.
Let me point this out to you. And this was, again, one of those ugly varieties of wheat that the farmers and the scientists and everyone said,
that's useless.
Whatever, it went extinct. Who cares? Build the condominium. Throw it away. And
exactly.
And who knows? This genetic material, we don't know. It's supremely arrogant to think that we know everything that a crop can be used for today. We need to preserve it for tomorrow, where hopefully some of our children will be wiser than we and may have a use for it and may have a need for it. We'll be back in just a moment with Carrie Fowler of the Global Crop Diversity Trust in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1146.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, talking with Casey Fowler of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. They've built the Svalbard Global Seed Vault 130 yards into the center of an impenetrable mountain in Norway to protect the world's seeds. I just want to remind everybody, we're still in March, so I can remind you of one of the early experiments with monocultures and how when you get a problem or a blight, things can go wrong. There was this little thing in my family's history called the Irish Potato Famine. And that was a monoculture, and you had a blight that affected one type of potato, but that potato was planted throughout Ireland, throughout most of Europe, actually, and it failed for 3 years in a row. And that's what can happen if you don't protect the diversity on the ground. But, Mark, you were going to ask a question about...
Carrie, how does somebody make a withdrawal? Okay, a country needs to take a look at its wheat production for whatever reason. How do they make a withdrawal? How do they... go to your seed bank and say, I need whatever variety of wheat. It's gone.
Sure. Well, the seed vault is going to operate very much like a safety deposit box at the bank. Different countries or institutions will place a duplicate copy of their collections up there. If they lose all or part of their collection, they'll simply make a request of us, and we will send it back. So they won't essentially have really lost anything. It's not going to be a time capsule. I should probably stress that. It's not a facility where we put seeds in and lock it up and walk away and forget about it, because eventually all seeds do die, even under the best conditions. But as the seed banks that have deposited samples up there need to take their seeds out periodically and grow them and get new fresh seeds for their own seed bank, then they will, in those circumstances, will send a new copy, new fresh copy up to Svalbard. So we'll have a living facility that continually has fresh seed cycling in. Even though many of the seed samples up there will, in fact, be able to last a long time. I mean, there's experimental data that would indicate that a sorghum seed, for example, could even last for close to 20,000 years. And
that's a really long time.
That's a long time, but we won't need it to really work that way in order to have a successful seed vault.
I'm curious because so many of these seeds, and throughout history, Uncle Bob has this one variety of corn that he's been growing on his farm for years and years and years, and he keeps planting and replanting that variety. And so he's got his own specific strain of corn that basically nobody else has. How are you collecting those seeds from that kind of micro
farm
system, micro farm?
Well, a couple of different ways. In the United States, for example, there's an organization called the Seed Savers Exchange, which your listeners can find at seedsavers.org. It's a group of amateur gardeners and farmers that trade these heirloom seeds and conserve them. They actually have made a deposit in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, so they have a backup copy of varieties such as the one you just described. At the Global Crop Diversity Trust, we're looking worldwide at the collections that are in seed banks and trying to see where the genetic gaps exist in those collections. And we're particularly interested in helping agriculture prepare for what's coming with climate change. So we're beginning to have a we're starting a competitive grants program where we will pay researchers and scientists to go out and collect diversity that we don't think we have in seed banks right now that will be useful for climate change in the future.
We only have a minute left, but you know, the media did come up with the moniker the Doomsday Vault. But in the case of a global catastrophe, in the case of something that really interrupts agriculture on a whole continent or across continents, you know, the worst case scenario, you know, being something nuclear or something, you know, really horrible, whether man-made or otherwise, and we can't get, you know, back to where we can grow crops well for 100 years. You've designed this thing to still be there and to be the repository of crops that could restore the genetic diversity that would be lost in such a case. Is that true?
That's right. Of course, we can't give any guarantees. We don't know what the nature of this global catastrophe would be. But
I don't think you would have to worry about giving a guarantee for 100 years, Carrie.
Doesn't sound like it.
How do I redeem that?
But we hope for the best, and we do think we have a facility that can stand just about anything, and we hope it'll make a contribution. But it's like any insurance policy. You get up in the morning and you go out to work in your car, perhaps. You don't plan on having an accident, and you hope you're not going to have an accident, but you have car insurance anyway, and that's what we've done.
Well, Carrie, I think the work that you've done there is incredible and
Very important.
And very important to the world. And thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to find out more about the Global Crop Diversity Trust, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you up with a bunch of interesting stories about this magical project. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking about global plant diversity, and I have to say, in everything, Mark, in everything that we do today, I remember when I was a kid, my father would be thrilled at when the Jersey tomatoes came out. But when you went to the supermarket, you got one type of tomato.
Right.
The apples we have today are Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, or that we had through the 80s were Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, occasionally a Macintosh, and that was about it. And now we're starting to see some taste for a variety now.
Well, when Carrie was on 60 Minutes earlier this week, he made a really good example of apples. In the 1800s, we had 7,100 different varieties of apples that you could, that depending on where you were, 7,100 different varieties of apples that you could eat. We currently have 300 of those left.
Crazy.
6,800 varieties of apples are extinct. They're gone.
Gone. They don't exist.
They're gone. They don't exist anymore. We can't. And there's no way to recreate them.
You know, it's funny. I remember just from a culinary perspective, I remember I was up in Vermont at a friend's farm, and there was an old apple tree on the farm. And it wasn't even an orchard. It was just an apple tree. But it gave fruit. And we shook the apple tree and went up in the low branches and shook them and pulled down some apples from there. And I remember it had a white, white, white flesh with a texture like no apple I'd ever had before in my life. And the skin was so red that when you bit in it, like your teeth streaked the red color into the white apples. And it was, I mean, if you told me it wasn't an apple, it was a different kind of fruit, I'd have believed you. But this was an old apple tree, and they prized it. They're like, yeah, there are only two of these trees left on the farm, but this is an old variety of apple. And they didn't know the name of it, but it was Grandpa's apple tree. And
if there are two of them left, though, shouldn't you cross-pollinate and make a third?
Maybe they, if they have apples, I think they do every year. But, I was fascinated by that, and I was struck even then, and that had to be like 96 or so, I was struck by the dearth of selection that we now have in all being the same.
I mean, you go to a farmer's market now, if you're lucky, you can find 10, 12 varieties of apples. Isn't that wonderful? To think that there were 7,100 varieties of apples that just aren't there anymore.
Well, keeping this is all about you having interest in it and you wanting to eat different things and you staying active and eating good food every day. So keep on doing that. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC, the time is 12 noon.